Hi, and welcome back to another episode of Crime at the Family Table. So, this will be another solo episode. Unfortunately, Latanya and I cannot get together scheduling wise to do this episode, but we have a very interesting case for you all today. Also, this will be the last episode of this season. So, we will be taking a short break and we'll be back with new cases, some changes in the podcast, but we are definitely looking forward to getting a break and looking forward to just refreshing ourselves and our little show so that we can give you bigger and better next season. Like I said, today will be a solo episode for us. It'll just be me, your illustrious host, Alyssa. I definitely miss Latanya, and we will be back together really soon. Just a disclaimer, trigger warning, we will be talking about folks being unalived in a very traumatic way. So if that is something that you are not comfortable with, catch one of our previous episodes, catch us next season. But we want you to take care of yourselves and your mental health above all else. We also, before I begin, I do want to take the time, and I know I can speak on behalf of Latanya, just to say thank you for listening, for sharing, for bearing with us through technical difficulties, for our little guest co-host, because I am a busy mom. We just thank you for hanging in there with us, and we promise to have bigger and better moving forward. But thank you and enjoy the show.
Frank Lloyd Wright was born in Richland Center, Wisconsin on June 8, 1867. He was the son of William Carey Wright, a preacher and a musician, and Anna Lloyd Jones, a teacher whose large Welsh family had settled in the Valley area near Spring Green, Wisconsin. Now keep that place in mind. We're going to put a pin in that. So in his early childhood, he moved around a lot as his father traveled from one ministry position to another. Like, he was a pastor, so he had to travel and basically go where the gigs were. Sometimes he would be in Rhode Island, Iowa, and Massachusetts before they eventually settled in Madison, Wisconsin in 1878. So eventually his parents divorced in 1885. They were already having some financial challenges, and that kind of made things even more difficult. So his mother's family was actually, they were pretty well to do. So they would help like his dad get some work, and eventually he became the secretary of the Unitarian Church. His mother's brother, so Frank Lloyd Wright's uncle, was like a pretty serious figure and leader in the Unitarian Church. So his father goes from being a Baptist preacher to the Unitarian religion, and like I said, he became the secretary of the church. So eventually at 18 years old, Frank Lloyd Wright, to help support his family, he worked for the dean of the University of Wisconsin's Department of Engineering while also studying at the university. Now back then they didn't have like architectural courses, so he had to study engineering. But he really knew he wanted to be an architect. And fun fact, while pregnant, his mother actually said, like, my baby's going to build beautiful buildings. And she would cut out pictures of like cathedrals from magazines and put them on his nursery wall. So I thought that was pretty cute. So in 1887, he left Madison for Chicago, where he found work with two different firms before being hired by Adler and Sullivan, who were like a big deal at that point. And he worked directly under Lewis Sullivan for 6 years. So Frank Lloyd Wright is making his way up the architectural chain. He's becoming that guy. At age 22, he married Catherine Lee Tobin, who I believe is his wife, Kitty. So he was just like really eager to build his own home. He negotiated a 5-year contract with Sullivan in exchange for the loan to you know, the money to fund his own house. So he purchased a wooded corner lot in the Chicago suburb of Oak Park and built his first house. That's also where he met his first mistress, but we'll get back to that. It was a modest residence, reminiscent of the East Coast shingle style with its prominent roof gable. If anybody knows architecture or loves houses or HGTV, you know what I'm talking about. So it also reflected Wright's ingenuity as he experimented with geometric shapes and volumes in the studio and playroom he later added for his growing family of six children. Count them, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So, his children would say that their household was lively. It was filled with beautiful things. It's noted that Frank Lloyd Wright found it hard to go without. He was a spender. And of course, we can guess that that comes from his childhood because there was a lot of financial strain. He grew up in poverty. So usually those folks go on to overspend or want a lot of things. So this is what was happening. The more and more he spent tempted him into accepting independent residential commissions. So the more he wanted to spend, the more he had to work. Now, although he did these on his own time, when Louis Sullivan became aware of them, he charged Wright with a breach of contract. Because obviously, you know, you got to go through the firm. You can't just be doing side gigs. So it's not clear whether Frank Lloyd Wright quit or was fired, but he left. And that kind of created a rift between the two of them. And their relationship wasn't repaired for nearly like 20 years. So this split, however, presented the opportunity for him to go out on his own. So he started his own firm. He opened an office and he began seeking to design homes that he believed would truly belong on the American prairie. And the prairie style of architecture is his style. So the William H. Winslow House was his first independent commission from his own firm. And this was a little more conservative in comparison to work he was doing a few years later. But nonetheless, it got the attention of the locals. So he was determined to just stamp himself in American architecture over the next 16 years. And he really set the standard for what, like I said, became known as the prairie style. To try and paint you a picture again, these houses reflected the long, low, horizontal prairie on which they sat, with low-pitched roofs, deep overhangs, no attics or basements, and generally long rows of casement windows that further emphasized the horizontal theme. So I'm thinking like one floor homes, those like homes you see out in the suburbs that you're like, wow, what a cute little quaint little home. So some of his most important residential works of the time are the Darwin D. Martin House in Buffalo, New York, the Avery Coonley House in Riverside, Illinois, and the Frederick C. Roby House in Chicago, which I've actually heard of that one. And he also designed the Guggenheim Museum. Like, are you kidding me? So there's pictures of his work if you want to Google it and look it up. He actually has done like amazing work. It's crazy. So at this point, we're in 1909. He's just like, my creativity, I'm spent. I'm restless emotionally. And here's where the tea comes in. And now for the tea. So Martha Borthwick, keep this name in mind. So in 1903, when Frank Lloyd Wright was commissioned to design a house for Edwin Cheney, who was a neighbor at the time in Oak Park, he started to fall for the man's wife. Now, Martha was an American translator who had an affair with Frank Lloyd for a number of years. Mind you, Frank Lloyd Wright has 6 kids and a wife of his own. So Martha was like a modern woman for that time. She had different interests outside of being a homemaker, a wife, and a mom. She was like an early feminist. She was also an intellectual. So they could have, you know, different types of conversations than he was probably having with his wife. So they started a relationship, and they could often be seen around town driving around in his car. So they were out in the open. They weren't hiding. So in 1909, they actually left their spouses and kids behind to go to Europe. So they lived in Florence, Italy at first with Frank's oldest son, Lloyd. And then they just moved together in another part of town in Italy. So at this time, Edwin, Martha's husband, granted her a divorce. I guess he was like, you done ran off to another country with this man, like, go ahead and be done with me. But Frank Lloyd's wife, Kitty, at the time, because he's been married like 3 times. So his wife at the time, Catherine or Kitty, she refused to give him a divorce. So eventually, Frank and Martha come back to the U.S. in like October of 1910. And the following year, he got land. So Frank Lloyd starts building basically a home, a hideaway in Spring Green, Wisconsin for he and Martha, which he named Taliesin. Taliesin? Taliesin. However, it became known in the press, like their home became known in the press as Love Cottage or the Castle of Love. It was like a major scandal of that day, of course. So as you can imagine, back in those days, the neighbors had something to say about it. Even like the local school superintendent had something to say about it, about what poor example it was for the local youth to see two people just blatantly disregarding their marriages, right? The townspeople even went so far as to call the sheriff to get Frank Lloyd Wright arrested. But he did not care. He was quoted by a reporter stating, "Two women were necessary for a man of artistic mind, one to be the mother of his children and the other to be his mental companion, his inspiration, his soulmate." I know, crazy. Unfortunately, things would take a tragic turn for the two in August of 1914. On the afternoon of August 15th, 1914, while Wright was in Chicago working on the design of Midway Gardens, his mistress and her 2 children, 8-year-old Martha and 12-year-old John, sat down for lunch on the porch at Taliesin. Inside the main dining room, at the other end of like a 20-foot long passageway, his draftsmen and laborers were also gathered around a table to be served lunch by Julian Carlton, a handyman and a servant. He was originally from Barbados, who had spent the summer waiting tables and, you know, just doing housework around the estate. His wife, Gertrude, did most of the cooking. So they both worked there and they lived on the estate as well. Now, as the employees of the estate ate their soup inside the dining room, 19-year-old draftsman Herbert Fritz and the rest of the people that were at the table noticed something unusual. And he's quoted to say, "We heard a swish as though water was thrown through the screen door. Then we saw some fluid coming under the door. It looked like dishwater. It spread out all over the floor," he recalled. That wasn't dishwater. It was actually gasoline. So Julian Carlson had come in earlier and asked if he could get some gasoline because he had to clean some rugs. I'm assuming back then that's how you clean rugs. Not sure, but they thought nothing of it and they were like, yeah, sure. And eventually they realized that that's what he was doing. So they had just served soup to Martha, Wright's mistress, and her children. So Julian actually told his wife Gertrude to leave. He then went to the porch wielding a hatchet. He had a large axe and he attacked Martha and her two children before dousing the floors with gasoline and setting the entire house on fire. The dining room burst into flames. The door was slammed shut and locked. He like bolted the doors and the windows. So Fritz is like, his clothes are burning. His hair is on fire. He jumps out the window next to where he was seated and he rolled down the hillside to put out the flames. As Fritz looked back, he saw Taliesin in flames and Carlton wielding his hatchet against his co-workers who had broken through. So they broke through the doors that were barricaded and tried to get through the window to the courtyard. But Carlton was standing there waiting for them with an axe. Although badly burned and wounded, Master Carpenter Billy Weston, who had actually built Taliesin, and the gardener David Lindblom managed to escape with Fritz. So they walked about a half mile to the nearest house to phone for help. If you know, a half mile is probably about a 10-minute walk, but if you are badly burned and seriously wounded, it probably took a lot longer. So some of the townspeople rushed over to the scene and they found the bodies of Martha, her two young children, two workers, and a 13-year-old boy. The 13-year-old boy turned out to be Billy Weston's son, whom he had bought to work that day. So eventually, Mr. Lindblom, the gardener, succumbed to his burns and he died. Seven people in total had died. Only two survived, Fritz and Billy Weston. So hours later, you know, the police have gotten there. They're trying to figure out what's going on. They discovered the killer barely conscious inside the basement furnace. He had actually ingested hydrochloric acid. So he thought he was taking a lethal dose that was going to kill him, but it turns out it wasn't enough and it didn't kill him. So he ends up being taken to prison and he actually dies of starvation several weeks later. Why? Not because he was starving himself, but because the hydrochloric acid was basically doing damage and it was burning away at his esophagus and his stomach, so he couldn't eat. He ends up dying a slow death of starvation. But he never gave a motive for why he attacked everybody, and he pled not guilty. He never went against that guilty verdict until the day he died. So Gertrude Carlton, his wife, actually said that Julian became increasingly paranoid weeks before the attack. He even started keeping a hatchet in a bag next to the bed. Lindblom, who was the gardener who eventually passed away, he said of Carlton, if anyone around there ever did him any dirt, he would send him to hell in a minute. There were also, of course, rumors that workers were possibly like saying some racial slurs to him. There was also allegedly an argument a few days earlier about like a horse. One of the surviving workers said that Martha had actually told Gertrude and Julian that they were being let go. Apparently, Frank Lloyd Wright had put like an advertisement in the paper for their positions and it got back to Carlton that they were about to be fired. So Gertrude actually confirmed that they were going to take a train back to Chicago that night to look for work. So even after all this is happening, the public still remained really fascinated and fixated on the relationship between Frank Lloyd and Martha. And newspapers still referred to Taliesin as the Love Cottage. One of the papers even reported that some neighbors pointed to, you know, the ruins, the burnt ruins of the, quote, Kingdom of Love as the strongest argument that the avenging angel still flies. So people were still feeling some type of way that they were kind of parading their love and their romance around. But this unfortunate occurrence, I don't know if I would say it never got like a resolution, but I mean, the killer died a very slow and painful death. Unfortunately, exactly what he inflicted on his victims. But that's it. That is the part about this tragedy, this fire, this massacre at Taliesin and Frank Lloyd Wright. Even after the fire, through his grief, Frank Lloyd Wright rebuilt the home, and by the end of the year, get this, he had fallen in love with another woman, a different woman who wrote him a condolence letter. They would eventually get married in 1923 after his wife, Kitty, finally agreed to their divorce. 2 years after that, another fire occurred and he rebuilt it again. This estate is now a historic landmark. You can actually go tour. It attracts thousands of tourists each year. If you did want to go check it out, think about us. Check it out. Learn some history. It's still in Spring Green, Wisconsin. And I'm sure it's actually very interesting because, like I said, Frank Lloyd Wright is probably the greatest architecture of our time. And he definitely has beautiful works throughout America. So that's the story of Frank Lloyd Wright. He was very eccentric, an interesting man. Clearly, he was a lover of many. But that's it. That's our episode for today. So that's it. That's the episode. I just want to thank you all once again for just being with us this season, bearing with us this season through the tests, the trials, the tribulations of our little podcast. We are very grateful and we really hope you return and just bear with us again this upcoming season. We will be taking a short break, but we'll be right back with more interesting cases. Like I've been saying, bigger and better and bolder. So once again, thank you all for listening. Thank you for sharing. On behalf of LaTanya, thank you for just your interest in true crime and your interest in us. And we'll see you next season. Bye.